Part 4, Chapter 13, in which Harvey is rejected. Quote, "That most fecund ditch of all, the folly that man does, or must suffer, if he woos a proud woman, not kindred of his soul." Footnote, William Butler Yeats, from the poem, A Dialogue of Self and Soul. O lovelorn and lamentable captain, O pain of repulsion, O abandoned Minotaur in his labyrinth of gloom, how will you bear the burden of the arrow that has found you, to love each woman you see, but be loved by none in return? Where is the angelic Ariadne who will save you from the hole in your heart? The cheapest hotel with a room available was the Hotel Mazzanti near the Piazza Erbe. It was late when they arrived, and they turned in directly. At 7 the next morning, Harvey was stirred by the sound of clinking silverware, and he went downstairs to investigate. It was the daughter of the owner of the hotel. She was setting the tables for breakfast, spreading the tablecloths and putting out the cups and saucers. Harvey was comforted by the simple ceremony, for he could tell she had been doing the chore for many years past, and she would be doing it for many more to come. And no matter where his footsteps led him, or how chaotic his universe became, he could be sure that on any given morning this lovely woman would be preparing these same tables in this same way. As soon as Harvey sat down, Flavia, which was the woman's name, brought him his coffee. Harvey gave her his best smile, but unfortunately Cupid's arrow was working to perfection, and though she did smile back, and quite sweetly at that, she didn't show him any attention beyond what came naturally in the warmth and courtesy of her nature. Harvey watched her as she went about her work until she disappeared in the kitchen. Then Mahogany and Edothea came down, and after they had had their fill of bread and jam, they all went out to find lodgings for the captain. At first Mahogany considered putting Harvey in a hotel, so the staff could watch over him while he and Edothea were away, but he quickly discovered it was impossible to find a room for more than a week. Forced to look for an apartment, they went through a number of listings until they found one in the center of town. The morning was bustling with people as they started up the Corso Santa Anastasia, following it until its name changed to Porta Borsari and then to Corso Cavour. The evolving appellations were not uncommon in Italy, and it pleased the captain, for it seemed to him that the different parts of a street were no more the same than the different parts of a journey. Each place along the way had its own history and characteristics, and it was only logical that the name of the street should change as it changed. He thought of how absurd it was that something that was so many things would carry an unchanging label, or that a growing, evolving person would forever be called by the same name. When they passed under the Roman arches at Corso Cavour, they turned onto Via Catulo and followed it to Vicolo Noris, which led them to the Roman Colosseum in the center of town. The amphitheater, or arena, as it is called, was built at the beginning of the 1st century A.D., covering an area of 450 by 360 feet. Second in size only to the Colosseum in Rome, the bulk of its structure was built with massive stones mortared together, and the central core was faced with stone quarried from the hills of Verona. As in the capital, it was used in ancient times for gladiatorial, animal, and naval battles, and was the meeting place for all informal business in the city. Over the years, it took on the personality of whoever inhabited it. It became a house of prostitution when the external wall was destroyed by an earthquake and local brothels were set up under its arches. It became a fortress against invading armies during the centuries of military strife, and it became a meeting place again in 1913 when it opened its doors for the birth of the world's most famous outdoor opera. The apartment Mahogany found at 38A Vicolo Tre Marchetti was close enough to feel the arena's shadow. As soon as they rang the bell, a short, gray-haired woman opened the door, and Irothea stated their business. At first the landlady shook her head, saying the studio apartment was for one person only. But when Irothea assured her only the captain would be staying, she paused to look him over. Not impressed, she was about to send him away, when he addressed her in the dialect of her native Alto Adige. She fell back a step, and a smile spread wrinkles across her face. "Filio mio!" she cried, stepping forward to embrace him. Thrilled to meet someone from her own hometown, Asia, which was the old woman's name, became a whirlwind of animation. She led them up the inner stairs, explaining that the building had once been a single home, and that it had been converted into apartments when the owner purchased a villa outside of town, and that the garret apartment on the roof had been built as a music room for the owner's daughter, and that the girl had died of pneumonia, and that though her father had decided to rent the room, he insisted on keeping his daughter's piano just as she had left it. The studio was lovely. Its windows opened to the west and the south, overlooking the arena and the Piazza Bra, and it had a stove, a breakfast table, a couch that opened into a bed, and a small water closet with a narrow tub. Harvey went over to the piano and began to play from the music that had been left there, the favorite piece of the ill-fated daughter, and Asia was moved to tears. Without a word, she took out the keys to the apartment and placed them in Harvey's hand. Mahogany tried to be formal about the transaction, but Asia refused to accept a deposit, and she had to be persuaded to accept any rent in advance. Once his lodgings were settled, it occurred to Mahogany that the captain might need some money. He soon discovered that the only bank which would open an account for an American passport was the Banca d'America e d'Italia on the Piazza Erbe. They were attended by a young teller named Anna, and, as the era would have it, Harvey fell instantly in love. Standing to the side of the window, wishing he were a bill, he watched her slender fingers as they counted out Mahogany's deposit. When everything was arranged, Mahogany treated the group to lunch, then returned with Irothea to Florence. Left to himself, Harvey wandered the streets. The influence of Aphrodite's poison made him desperate in his search for a companion, and he quickly discovered that the Via Mazzini, the most prestigious shopping street in Verona, was his best bet. Like many of the avenues in the city, it was closed to traffic, and the shoppers could take their time as they looked at the window displays. Harvey was more interested in the attractive items in front of the windows, and he gazed at them as wistfully as they gazed at the items behind the glass. But, unfortunately, not a single woman would look at him, for they could all sense his desperation, and they were repulsed by it. After a while, Harvey looked into the windows himself. His first glance at his empty reflection shook him with a wave of dread, but then he saw beyond the reflection to the articles on the other side. "So this is what the shoppers are seeking," he thought. "Not a true reflection, but an embellished one, adorned with the trappings of fashion." Harvey was imagining how lovely he looked in an evening gown and earrings when a stranger handed him a card advertising the opening of a new discotheque in town. At 10 o'clock that evening, Harvey was standing in line, waiting to get in. Initially, he was not certain he was really there, for the first 5 women he saw looked right through him. But then the doorman asked him for 60,000 lire, and he knew that he was. When he stepped inside, he felt he had entered a room of giant ants. Everywhere he looked were silk and spandex-covered limbs, poking and feeling and waving about. Balanced on heels and designer shoes, they stood on their hind legs, picking and clawing their way toward some vital destination. Harvey fell in behind a wall of legs and antennae that were crawling over and around one another, and when the levee broke, he was swept into the main bar. From there he continued, shuffling on his little feet, scratching and squeezing his way through the flesh and fashions, until he found himself pressed against an enormous speaker. The single, unaltered assault of a rap music superhit ripped through him and reduced his organism to single-cell simplicity. He could see the ants on the floor twitching and poking their exaggerated body parts, shrouded in a smoky haze of a thousand points of light. The silk and spandex stretched and pulled as restless insects rubbed past stationary ones, and the room was wrapped into an amoebic mass. A long-legged wasp caught him in her antennae and pulled him into a rivulet of people that snaked across the floor. The current pushed and slipped until it met another rivulet, and the two formed a stream that clogged for a moment near the bar, then broke loose and deposited him in front of a queen bee. The drones and workers circled about, lighting her cigarettes and buying her drinks, while she completely ignored them, looking scornfully across the room at a rival queen. The bar was a model of economic success. 500 people in an unfurnished room, listening to a $10 CD make enough noise to drown out conversation, while the empty puppets bought drink after drink to hide their insecurity. The entire setup was designed to inhibit people from being able to talk and get to know each other, for the proprietors knew that only lonely, searching singles would return to spend their money night after night after night. When Harvey returned to his apartment, the piano was waiting, and he sat down to play. He chose a nocturne by Chopin, but as soon as he touched the keys, he heard the echo of another piano coming from the stairs. It was as if someone were answering his call, playing a counter-melody which transformed his soliloquy into a dialogue between loved one and lover. The sublime harmonies moved like waves that issued from two shores, rolling and meeting in a flash of foam, then passing through one another to expire at the foot of the one they sought. Harvey rose and went to the door, but when he did, the echo ceased, and each time he repeated the process, it produced the same result. As the weeks passed, Harvey never did discover who was playing the counterpart to his song, but that didn't stop him from carrying on a musical conversation that touched on topics from destiny to favorite foods, from politics to poetry, and from ontogeny to snoring in bed. In fact, he managed to express the whole of human experience in terms of rhythms, runs, and motifs. Outside the apartment, Harvey continued to live the life of an unrequited Romeo. Falling in love at every step, despised at every turn, he roamed the streets and alleys and combed the boardwalk of the Piazza Bra. Footnote. The Listone, a marble walkway that runs along one side of the plaza, is one of the most famous boardwalks in Italy. The Veronese have coined the expression fare una vasca sul Listone, go for a bath on the Listone, meaning to make one pass the length of the walk. Every evening, Harvey watched the parade, the women modeling their wares, mirroring the window fashions, and he fell in love with them all, the daring ones who bounced freely and wore coats to make an obscene outfit respectable, the youthful ones who were careless with their skirts as they rode by on bikes, and the conservative ones who walked with a hand on their purse, making sure nothing would swing. But only the homosexuals in the plaza would give Harvey the time of day. One man even invited him to spend an afternoon at Lake Garda, and it might have been the perfect place for the captain to find a female, but his friend's personality took such complete control that Harvey did not even notice the plethora of breasts and nipples that relaxed around him. By the time they returned to Verona, the captain had begun to feel the same attraction to his friend as his friend felt toward him. But on the way to Harvey's apartment, the tight derriere of a passing Lothario caught his companion's eye, and he stopped to stare. The captain stared too, which sent his friend into a jealous rage, which sent Harvey into a jealous rage, which embroiled the potential lovers in a raging dispute. The fight continued until the man threatened never to speak to Harvey again, and Harvey threatened the same. Then he pretended to walk away, and so did Harvey. Then he really did walk away, and the captain never saw him again. Eventually, Harvey would almost always end up at the Piazza Erbe, sitting on the steps of the Berlina, gazing up at the statues atop the Palazzo Maffei. Footnote. The Berlina is a small square structure used in Roman times during the ceremonies of investiture, when citizens were elected to public office. The statues of Hercules, Zeus, Aphrodite, Hermes, Apollo, and Athena stand atop the Palazzo Maffei. Harvey imagined the gods atop the palazzo were mocking him, laughing at his futile search, and he vowed that one day he would climb to the top of their roof and listen to what they were saying. After a month of rejection, he had just about given up on finding a companion when he remembered the lovely teller at the bank. The first time he had seen her, her long hair had been down on her shoulders, but this time it was pulled back, and she looked more professional. She recognized the captain when he came in, and her warmth inspired him to make a move. When he had completed his transaction and was counting his withdrawal, he asked her, "Non vorresti aiutarmi a spenderli?" Translation: "Would you like to help me spend it? The money?" For a moment they had a real conversation, and he could tell she was honestly considering him. But then someone entered the bank, and he knew she would be embarrassed to accept an invitation with a person watching. He tried to hurry her into making a decision, which made her incapable of doing so, and so she said she would give him her answer tomorrow. The next day she told him she had altri impegni, other engagements, and before he could ask again, she changed the subject to how he liked Verona, and the question of going out was closed. He had heard those words, altri impegni, 100 times, and though they sounded sweeter in Italian than in English, their meaning was just the same. Still, unable to forget her, Harvey decided to give her one last chance and write her a poem. He decided the poem should be symmetrical, like the flawlessness of her features and the perfection of his feeling, and he worked it in such a way that her name was spelled repeatedly down the left margin, and also by the letters at the beginning and end of the 1st, 4th, 7th, and 10th lines, as well as within the words on the lines in between. Footnote. Only fragments of the original poem were ever found, but its structure is clear. Angelica della luna, nell'ombra che inganna, non cerca Anna del Luisignol, anch'io per fortuna ne Anna così care ne impanano, anzi Anna. When he gave her the verses, she was courteous in accepting, though of course she didn't want a poem. What she wanted was someone to challenge her to prove she was not just a pretty face. The next day Harvey found the pieces of his sonnet scattered in the street. A week later, Mahogany and Idothea stopped in on their way to visit Adelphine's mother in Mantua, and they took the captain along. It was raining when the train pulled out of Verona, and Harvey remembered the young girl he had seen on the same trip 44 chapters before. It was as if they were together again, staring at each other's reflections in the glass, looking out on the rain-soaked fields. He remembered the history they had imagined together, how they had become perfect Italian parents, living only for their children and renewing their passion on holidays. When Lago Superiore came into view, he remembered how their daydream had been shattered and how their life together had been reduced to an instant. The trip was nostalgic for Mahogany as well, and he had to brace himself before entering Silvia's apartment. It looked just as he remembered, except that there was now a television in every room. 3 of them were turned on when they sat down to dinner, and Silvia followed each of the different programs as she conversed with her guests. Mahogany was afraid to mention Adelphine, but he wanted to know if Sylvia had ever received her daughter's things. When he finally asked, Sylvia became suddenly quiet, then rose and turned off the televisions. "Mario told me about the accident," she said, "and a woman from Zante brought me the things that had been left in her villa. Of course, when I heard the news, I couldn't believe it. Adelphine had been so full of life when she left, and then only her suitcase returned, a brush, a robe, a few random things, empty without my daughter to hold them. It is a terrible pain," she said, "the pain of a mother who has lost her child. I don't know if I can explain. It is like the loss of a hand, or a limb, or several limbs. It is without consolation. It is a pain for this life and this death. Forever."